702.
WhatsApp Profilwe.
On 072-702-1702.
So in a continuation of our conversation centered around the 16 days of activism around violence against women and children, we're speaking to Dr. Shahida Omar, who is clinical director of the Teddy Bear Clinic. And of course, the Teddy Bear Clinic is an organization, an NPO that comes to the aid of children who have been at the receiving end of abuse. So today, Dr. Omar's giving us some tips on how to spot child sexual abuse and of course, intervene and help that child. Welcome to Weekend Breakfast, Dr. Shahida Omar. We really appreciate you making the time.
Thank you and good morning to everybody.
Dr. Omar, if you know, I think we should start with the very, very, very basics, which is, of course, the work that you do at the Teddy Bear Clinic, which began around in 1986 in response to the need for medical examinations for sexually abused children. As we sit now in 2022, how big is the problem of child sexual abuse?
So you articulated the fact that we've been around for more than 36 years and we are still around, and the increasing incidence of children being reported, which may be a positive because in the past there was less reporting, under-reporting, which is still the case, but I think that the extent and the availability and access to resources and awareness raising has certainly made people more aware and enlightened on accessing support for child victims of abuse. But we're still seeing more and more children being violated, even babies, toddlers, and children until the age of 18, because that's the age of majority. If we look at the statistics, we know that 1 in 3 girls, 1 in 4 boys continue to be victims of sexual abuse, underlying emotional abuse, physical abuse, and further trauma. And you've articulated the issue around 16 days of activism. We, of course, work on a 365-day campaign.
Yes.
And what we find that, of course, both girls and boys are victims. We cannot exclude or discount the fact that boys are not victims. They are also victims of sexual abuse. We find it, we find that boys find it more difficult to report the alleged abuse. But if we look at the numbers, mm-hmm. I can go and talk about numbers, which will never be an accurate reflection. But we need to appreciate and recognize that it is a reality, and it's not happening out there. It's happening within the midst of everybody. I think we cannot exclude any race, class, creed, any population group, because nobody's exempted from the scourge of violence.
Yeah. No one's exempted from the scourge of violence, and as you've pointed out, the sexual abuse of children isn't just designated to a certain class or race of people. But to that end, when we talk about, and we'll get into the signs of or how to spot sexual abuse, which is on the landing page of the Teddy Bear Clinic's website. When we talk about that, most people might want to think or might be inclined to think, well, it's something that happens. It's something that a stranger might do to a child. It wouldn't happen in my family. On average, who is the perpetrator, who tends to be a perpetrator of sexual abuse, or does it not help to have that kind of conversation? Being aware and being vigilant is the only thing that matters.
So it's a both and thing. Yes, being aware, being vigilant, but having that conversation and not having a once-off conversation, this needs to be an ongoing, consistent conversation. It's not about instilling anxiety and fear in a child, but it's about ensuring the safety and protection, and of course, ensuring that children are more aware and not fall prey to these kind of violations. So if we're looking at, you spoke to symptoms, and often people are, firstly, I want to just mention, you asked about the stranger danger.
Sure.
And who is actually more, responsible for this. So in 80 to 90% of cases, the reality is that it is somebody that is known to the child, that has some kind of relationship or has easy access and availability to the child. So it could be a family member, it could be somebody a friend. It could be somebody in the neighborhood. It could be somebody from the congregation, somebody from the school community. Mm-hmm. There's always somebody in and around that knows the child and that the child would not be vigilant about or fearful about. Yes, the stranger danger situation does exist. We do see that. We've seen the kidnappings, but there as well, it's usually people or syndicates or organized crime that know the whereabouts and more information around the family, so insider information. So, and with stranger danger, in our interventions, we have found in our clinical settings that the stranger danger is usually, you know, requesting help from a child for seeking some booty or needing to find a address or a lost pet. Mm. You know, those are the kind of ploys and tactics that are manipulated by the stranger danger, asking the child to get into the vehicle or accompany them if they're on foot. And of course, children, if we just look at how children are raised, they are socialized in respecting their elders, whether it's Malume, whether it's Gogo, whether it's anybody, they always show respect and will follow and accompany the person. And we've seen serial rapists working very strategically in being successful in violating children. And even with older children, it has been unfortunate that they've fallen prey to this kind of manipulation.
So in many ways, I hear you saying that we need to, and we'll get into the signs, possible signs of child abuse as per your website, but in many ways, thinking around how to help your child establish boundaries that are very firm and come into play, irrespective of any socialization that says you respect elderly people or you need to be nice or you need to be kind or you need to help, but where it doesn't feel right or where it's not appropriate, put your foot down, even as a child.
Indeed, and I think this is so important when I said about ongoing dialogues, where especially during this time of the year, everybody's exhausted physically, emotionally, mentally. People just want to relax and let go. And often the guard is let down because it's a festive period. It's time for family get-togethers. It's time for partying and of course, people engage in alcohol as a means of celebration. It doesn't mean that they're alcoholics, but of course, one becomes more disinhibited. And, you know, because children are not then watched as they would normally be watched, they could fall prey to violations. So the important thing is to have this discussion, talking about anybody and everybody, talking about rights and responsibilities, acceptable and unacceptable behaviors, talking about good secrets and bad secrets. And we don't talk about good touches and bad touches. If we have had this conversation before, because the body feels good when it's rubbed in a certain manner, but that, you know, doesn't mean that it is acceptable or appropriate. So we need to ensure we don't instill guilt in children, that they're actually feeling nice about this. Or they don't like what's happening, but it feels good because that's how the body is programmed. So having those kind of conversations, talking to children that whether it's an uncle, it's an aunt, it's another relation, it's people that, you know, visit the home frequently, it could be anybody, they need to understand that it is their right to say no, to stop, to reach out, that it's okay to come to the parents, because the conversations that we have around sex and sexuality are very limited. It is still considered a taboo subject, and children often are afraid to go to the ones whom they love most and whom they feel safest most with, it's their parents. And because that conversation has not been broached, they feel they, you know, are not in a position to come forward. I think any of us, you know, I always, when I have a group and I talk to them and I say, okay, let's look at the acronym MRSE, your most recent sexual experience. And I say, now share it with the person on the right. And, you know, adults, you find that they break out in a nervous laughter. And when you explore that, it's a conversation we don't have.
Yeah.
So, but a child who doesn't have the vocabulary, the words, but feels confused, feels not okay about it, how do they actually broach that? And therefore, it's important when you talk about boundaries to make the child realize that regardless of who it is, it's not acceptable and that it is their right to reach out and to engage in children within the conversations around signing or using a code or, you know, using some kind of a gesture to show that they're in trouble, they need help, they're not okay. Within family gatherings, within any kind of setting, I think it's important for the child to know that they are being supported and that they will be supported and that they will be validated.
Yeah.
So this needs to be done consistently, but with younger children, of course, age-appropriate language, and at the same time, checking and seeing if the child has understood what the parent has explained to the child. Because often we think the child has understood. So having a role play, rehearsing is important and critical to ensure that the child has processed this in the manner it is expected to.
Absolutely. Dr. Omar, you know, unfortunately, we've become, you know, as a nation, accustomed to being able to reel off the names of various children who have, you know, been abused, who have been killed in some of the most horrific ways. I mean, I'm thinking of this 4-year-old Bokgabo Bor, who went missing in Watville in October. You know, the same, and I was in Watville, I was in Benoni that same week when the community was looking for her. But because we were dealing with sort of end of life preparations and matters like that for my own grandmother, we were wrapped up in that. But, you know, it dawned on me that whilst everyday life is carrying on, some really horrific things are happening, and probably not just to Bokgabo right there in Watville, but to many other children within that space. And a key sort of tenant, I think, to the work that you do at Teddy Bear Clinic is not just to step in after children have been sexually abused, but you really are trying to make sure that you prevent sexual abuse of children as much as possible. So awareness is what we're aiming for this morning. Please talk us through those possible signs of child abuse when that a parent can spot, can be vigilant about, that a guardian can be vigilant about.
Thank you for that. So yes, parents need to be absolutely sensitive about any changes in their children's behavior. You know, with older children, what we see, sometimes the children have more money and they have gifts, and one doesn't question that. Or, you know, parents are so busy, they tend to overlook it. But that's also a sign that one needs to look out for. Like, where are they getting these things? Or they're coming in with maybe a new top or a shirt or a T-shirt. But those are things that are also telltale signs, something that we do not often think about.
Mm.
Also, look out for neighbors, family, friends who show preferential treatment towards one child or even to children. To see a 30-year-old focusing so much interest in a 3-year-old and wanting, you know, playing games, wanting, insisting on taking the child out to the park, to the zoo. Again, you know, there's cause for concern there, that what is it that's motivating this person? Then, of course, we also need to look at when children start showing signs of avoidance. So sometimes avoidance of the bathroom, avoidance of certain settings, which may remind them of the alleged abuse, because the alleged or an individual that may remind them of the alleged abuser. So when a blue person, sexually abuses a child, it becomes pervasive that the child, the moment the child sees another blue person, the child is going to cringe and is going to, you know, withdraw, and he's going to maybe have an outburst, and a parent cannot explain, like, what's going on. We had a young child, a 9-year-old, who refused to go to the toilet and became constipated. So the incontinence continued for a lengthy period of time, and there wasn't any medical explanation for that. In therapy, in play therapy, it emerged the child used to be taken by a family member out for the day to the movies or whatever, and was taken to the toilet and was anally penetrated in the toilet. So just those kind of things that people need to be aware of and vigilant. But also when children start walking awkwardly, they withdraw, isolate themselves, refuse to play or engage in activities that they previously enjoyed, loss of appetite, or eating too much, because food is a primary nurturer, and it's that hole in the heart that they cannot actually fill. They're sitting with it, pain and trauma and that wound, it's so deep, they're trying to fill it in whatever way. So they compensate by either eating too much, eating too little. And sleeping patterns, changing sleeping patterns are very important, where children may have recurrent nightmares, waking up at night, screaming, yelling, shouting, not wanting the lights to be put out, or sleeping too much even. You know, I think that's another telltale sign. And then, as I said, loss of bowel control, loss of bladder control. So the aneurysis and encopresis, that certainly, medical doctor needs to be consulted and ensure that there's a medical reason for that. But it is often a common manifestation when children feel out of control. They've lost control. They've been, they feel powerless and defenseless and helpless. That bedwetting and loss of bowel control is something that often presents as a problem. And also seeing when children start displaying age inappropriate behavior.
Yeah.
So what is age inappropriate behavior? Certainly a 5-year-old and 8-year-old start demonstrating French kissing or is engaging in sexual activities with other children. Those are things that one needs to be alerted to and aware of, that where does this child get this from? And I can continue, but there are many, many things. And the one thing I want to alert everybody to is that we have to look at this cluster of symptoms. We do not look at it in isolation. So singling out one behavior, so if a child loses attention span or concentration or becomes aggressive, or is overly weepy and shows signs of depression, again, look at the cluster of symptoms and follow up, always consult. I always say there's a 24-hour toll-free line of Childline. Consult, because there are child counselors online. Consult with medical professionals. Contact the Teddy Bear Foundation. So their help is a call away, and I think it's important for parents to realize that. And I always urge parents to be neurotic or on the side of caution. That should be the rule of thumb.
Yeah.
Never be nonchalant and think it's nothing or that the child has been ill, had flu symptoms, and now is probably just acting out because it's more than that.
And Dr. Omar, there's certainly a way to be vigilant or even neurotic, as you say, without making this the child's burden, right? So, quite often growing up, parents would say things like, don't walk with boys. And, there'd be various sort of euphemisms and phrases for, whatever they were worried about. And so you'd be, as a child, confused, paranoid, and thinking, I didn't know, boys were an issue or the problem. We go to school with them, we all play together. When in fact, parents aren't expressing what they actually want to say to you. And there's something else that underpins these statements. So there are ways for parents to do all of this without, of course, passing on their neuroses and anxieties to children, effectively allowing them to still be children.
Indeed. And I think it's again, as I said, age appropriate, because we don't want to induce stress in children. What we are finding, and you mentioned before I came online about the mental health and mental well-being of children, people in reality have suffered as a result of COVID and continue to suffer. So we have to be very careful on how this information is communicated to children. And sometimes to actually use, depending on the age of the child, to say, I don't want you to be afraid, but it's about ensuring your safety, to make sure that you are fine. And in the event, should anything happen, A, B, C, D, but it's always making sure that the child is understood, and it's not about the generalizing that fear to anybody and everybody, but that there are bad people in this world. Unfortunately, they are ill, and they lack control issues and violate children, because children cannot fight back, because children are small, they're tiny, and they're not in a position to fight back. So as a parent, they just concern. And of course, don't just label, like, don't walk with boys. Explain to children, like, it would be better if you do not walk alone, but always walk in groups. Inform us wherever you are, and if you're giving your child a cell phone, obviously there needs to be rules around that, and engaging with the child. So communication, conversations, and dialogues are critical between parents and children. And I think we also need to be aware that predators are everywhere, and they're looking for opportunities where children are online, children are unsupervised, children are at parties, and children may engage in, of course, as we know, vaping and alcohol, because it is freely available. I think we cannot deny that fact.
So
people need to consistently remind children, even during this period, about the risk factors, about the dangers, online dangers, frequenting parties or places where there is access to these substances.
Yep. Dr. Omar, we're going to have to leave it there for this morning, but thank you so much for, as always, availing yourself for these conversations. And of course, your expertise and your experience is much appreciated.